It's the 21st Show. I'm Christine Herman, in for Brian Mackey this week. We're talking about the taboo associated with menstruation, which persists despite the fact that every day millions of people are on their period. We're diving deep into this issue today on the 21st Show, and we're joined now by two researchers who study menstrual taboo and global health to provide some broader context. Aruba Fatima is a graduate student in biological anthropology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and she's studying menstrual taboo in Pakistan and other areas. Aruba, welcome to the 21st Show.
Hello. Thank you, Christine.
We're also joined by Marnie Sommer. She's a professor of socio-medical sciences at Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health and an expert in global health and development. Marnie, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be with you.
Aruba, let's start with you. So part of your research focuses menstrual taboo in Pakistan, and you were born and raised in Pakistan yourself. I wonder if you'd be willing to share with us a little bit about your own experience and what it was like when you first got your period.
Yeah, sure. So I was born and raised in Pakistan until I came to, and then I came to college to the United States. I think a lot of my period research stems from my own personal experiences and curiosity to understand why there is stigma and shame around discussing periods. So when I was growing up, I remember my first period, I just got lucky that my school had a period awareness session. So I remember I learned a lot during that. But during my conversations with my cousins or my friends who didn't go to my school, I realized that they did not get access to the same kind of information which I did. And I remember during our social gatherings or like private family and friends gathering, this was something that was not really discussed. If somebody was menstruating, they would not mention it at all. And I was just very, very curious why there's so much silence for something that everybody's collectively experiencing and would probably benefit from a conversation on how one's managing or like what kind of physical exercises they're doing or they're not doing, how to alleviate pain and things like those.
What have you learned in your research so far on this issue?
I think I have realized in my 5 years of menstruation stigma research is that it's not one reason. Coming from Pakistan and seeing how Pakistan's histories, colonial histories are intertwined with so many different regions. So many different contexts are also coming in. So a lot of factors are at play here, but some of those are how silence has been constructed in the region, especially when it is related to women's health and menstruation, to be more specific. So just how it has been constructed, how silence has been encouraged, how there's a sense of respectability that's inculcated in those menstruators who don't discuss menstruation publicly. So I feel like there are multiple factors at play. And then, of course, the context changes so much more when we move from one region to another, even when it's within Pakistan as well, so urban, rural, etc.
Absolutely. Marnie, can you help us step back for a moment and talk about this issue? We've been referring to it as period poverty, but it also goes by the term of menstruation equity. What do we know about the link between young girls getting their periods, perhaps not having access to period products or education, and then school absenteeism, missing out on school or even dropping out of school, and how this plays out in low and middle income countries?
Yeah, thanks for the great question. So I think we know a fair amount at this point. We have a lot left to learn, but we do know a fair amount about what I generally refer to as menstrual equity, but certainly period poverty is used widely as a term. And when we think about it, as my fellow speakers have articulated beautifully, it speaks to income levels, longstanding cultural beliefs, taboos, all the things that have been mentioned. We know that specifically around absenteeism and dropout, that one's been a little tricky to capture. And it's not because getting your period doesn't impact your ability to go to school, concentrate in school, do well in school, but that young people could be absent for lots of reasons. They may not articulate that menstruation is the reason they're not there, coming back to the issue of shame and taboo that we've talked about. And as was just referenced, there's lots of reasons they may be feeling those emotions and or frankly that they may be missing school that aren't just related to their period. So one thing we've tried to do over the years is bring attention to the broader issues of how menstruation may be impacting the ability to engage in the classroom, whether your head is down on the desk and you get in trouble because you're in pain or you don't feel well, and the teacher, perhaps a male or even a female teacher who is insensitized to the issue, may think that you're not performing well, and a young person could get punished when in fact they're frankly just not feeling well, but it's not something that they feel freely to convey. It may be that the school doesn't have adequate toilets or places to change, or they're not able to ask to use the facilities. And so that in itself may also just cause a lot of stress and anxiety, even if they're going to school each day. So while thinking about how this impacts the ability to attend school, and that's not unimportant, we think it's sort of one small piece of a larger puzzle of how this may be impacting young people's ability to thrive in school, to do well, to feel good about their schooling, to concentrate, to stand up and respond. In a lot of countries, you're expected to stand up every time you give an answer. But if you are worried about having blood on the back of your uniform, or you're squished into a bench with four other kids and you don't have a lot of room to check your skirt or your pants, your uniform, and see if there's anything on it, it just sort of makes it, I think, quite overwhelming to stand up. And that in turn might get you punished. So again, not to say absenteeism isn't important, but we do think that there's a lot of other ways we should be thinking about how this impacts a young person, a girl's ability to engage in the classroom. Similarly, when it comes to dropout, as I think one can take away from everything you've heard so far, there's lots of reasons that girls may leave school. Dropout could mean they drop out. It could mean they're convinced to leave. It could mean they're told to leave. There could be expectations around working in the household when they reach puberty, and menstruation could be a sign. It could be that there's fears about them walking to school after they start menstruating, because parents are aware that that may mean they're vulnerable to getting pregnant if someone approaches them. So again, dropout is a bit complicated. It's not unimportant, but the way I've always thought about it is, menstruation is sort of one final straw that may break the camel's back, which is a bit of a Western saying, or maybe an American saying, but it may not be the sole reason, which is not to say it can't be the sole reason. There was a movie that came out earlier this year called Impure that talks about one girl's story in East Africa and sort of the overwhelming shame that she experienced around schooling with her period after an accident and sort of the teasing. So when we think about menstrual equity or period poverty and young people and education, we like to think about it as a very holistic issue that needs a similar response, from getting adequate and informative and practical guidance in school timed for when they're actually getting their periods and onwards, so they can adjust to sort of how your period can be a bit irregular at first and then the different sort of flows. It includes having materials, whatever those are. They don't need to be menstrual products, commercial products. They could be reusables, they could be pads. So either making sure girls have them all the time, or at a minimum having an emergency stash of them for girls to use. It means having sensitized teachers who recognize what's going on and don't punish girls for asking to be excused or putting their head on the desk. It means sensitizing peers, boys and girls, other kids in the classroom, to be supportive and to not tease them. It means making sure that schools, frankly, in New York City, where I live, not just in Sierra Leone or in Pakistan, have adequate toilets that are clean, accessible, ideally have water and disposal units, and kids who are allowed to use them when they need them, which is a whole other issue. So I think that everything we've heard today fits into the broader context of what we know around menstrual equity and period poverty, but just that it's not a simplistic, there's not a silver bullet to solve it, which doesn't mean it's hard. It just means it's not one thing that's going to solve it.
Yeah, absolutely. Aruba, it's interesting to consider how a lot of the stigma around menstruation seems to be perpetuated in society, even through adults, whether it's your parents or your teachers. And, you know, we heard Khadija's story about it was an adult in her neighborhood that kind of, you know, made her feel a sense of shame. You mentioned adults, you know, kind of encouraging their children to conceal if you have your period. Can you talk a little bit more about that? And why do you think this messaging of shame and secrecy around periods and menstruation is so pervasive.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, because I've been thinking about Khadija's story since Noor mentioned it. I think this has been a very similar experience to for a lot of girls in Pakistan, where they have been shamed at some point during their early menstruation days, where they were not sure how to manage their blood flow or how to basically appear in public. And I've been thinking about it for quite some time. I've talked to a bunch of we call it secondary school in Pakistan, from grade 6 to 10. And I've talked to a bunch of secondary school girls who mentioned that this kind of shame and secrecy kind of has been generational. So if we talk to elders, they would have a similar response to what the current generation has, because this has not been questioned at multiple levels. So every generation has probably had those questions on, like, why there's stigma, or why we're not talking about periods, or why I can't really talk to another person if I'm experiencing something related to menstruation in public. I feel like these questions have been there, but nobody have been encouraged or like has been shut down. So I think shame and secrecy have been so ingrained in our society at this point that anybody doing otherwise is probably more notable than vice versa. So also I also feel like it has connections to how it has been normalized in our society, like not asking questions related to it. Just examples of that, I'm recalling some students that I used to teach in Karachi, Pakistan. They shared on why they, Professor Summer mentioned about absenteeism, and it reminded me of that, was a student mentioned that as soon as she started her periods, her parents told her not to go to school anymore, because she was also experiencing some menstruation-related disorders, which technically her parents could not afford to take her to the doctor. And when the parents did take her to the doctor, she felt that the doctor had a very shaming tone towards her parents. And she was like, I just don't want my parents to be shamed in front of a doctor. And that's why I stopped going to the doctor. But I also stopped coming to school during my periods. Every month I skipped 7 days of school, and all the teachers know about it. And I feel like this was her solution to managing the situation. But then it also screams a lot of like how silence and shame operates in our society and at a more individualistic level. But I'm sure the story of this particular student is not the only story. There are so many others who are struggling because of this.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce our guests here. Aruba Fatima is a graduate student in biological anthropology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We're also speaking with Marnie Summer, a professor of sociomedical sciences at Columbia University. We got a text message from one of our listeners, John in Rockford. He says, in Gaza, women and girls are facing a severe menstrual hygiene crisis due to the ongoing conflict, with limited access to sanitary products, clean water, and safe sanitation facilities. This crisis is exacerbating the humanitarian emergency, leading to health risks and to psychological distress. Marnie, I wonder if this is something you can comment on, whether you're aware of what's happening specifically in Gaza on this issue, or just more broadly about how war and living in conflict zones can affect menstrual health and hygiene.
Yeah, I really appreciate that question from John, and raising awareness not just of Gaza, but the realities of humanitarian context. And there are currently, I believe, around 120 million folks who are displaced around the world. You hear less about it, but there's enormous displacement in Sudan and in other countries. And so about a decade ago, my team at Columbia University partnered with the International Rescue Committee. We received some funding from the British government to partner with the larger global humanitarian community, which we did, about 29 organizations, to explore what are the needs of girls and women in humanitarian response, how are the current excellent and perhaps more grassroots humanitarian response organizations addressing them, both in post-conflict and post-disaster scenarios, and what is practical guidance that could help to improve the way in which their needs are met and response folks feel more prepared to address them. So in about 2017, we launched what we call the MHM, Menstrual Hygiene Management and Emergencies Toolkit, co-published by 29 organizations, including UNHCR, UNICEF, IRC, all the big organizations that respond to places like Gaza when they're able to enter, or to other places around the world that, again, maybe are less in the news but have dire situations for girls and women. And then we subsequently actually got funding from the U.S. government to look at some follow-on work in relation to disposal, waste management, and laundering, because those are not particularly sexy topics, but women and girls in all these contexts need to be able to dispose of or wash their menstrual materials, whether they're cloth or commercial pads. And as we've heard about today, shame and silence are a big issue. And when you're displaced, you're living in very confined quarters. Usually it may be, you know, we did work, we were visiting some camps in Northwest Tanzania where there were Congolese and Burundian refugees. And you might have 10 folks living in a tent there or in a home. Similarly, we saw the same numbers living in tents in very hot conditions in northern Nigeria. And so we know that that how you are able to dispose of or get rid of your menstrual
material, recording stopped,
is really important. In addition, there are in many places folks are not comfortable talking to girls and women about these issues. Maybe they feel embarrassed, or their male staff. So the toolkit, and then we did some additional guidance in a context of Ebola response, which I won't get into, but just to say it is a real issue. There is good guidance out there. A lot of the response organizations are aware of it. But one of the things I think is challenging is when you go into a response, folks understandably focus on water, shelter, food, some of the most immediate needs. And while we would argue girls and women cannot get in line to get food, they cannot go pick up water, they cannot do all those things if they aren't able to manage their menstruation, if they can't leave where they're living.
I think Marnie, I'm sorry to interject here. We're coming up on a short break, but we'll pick up this conversation when we get back. We'll continue this conversation about period poverty and menstrual equity. I'm Christine Herman. This is The 21st. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Christine Herman. We're talking about the persistent stigma associated with periods and menstruation. And we're going to take this conversation, bring it a little closer to home for the rest of the hour. We invite your thoughts. We have a caller on the line who we'll get to in a moment. If you'd like to join us as well, our number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We got this text from Gina in Springfield. She says, "This is a difficult topic to discuss. I admire you for being willing to tackle it. I'm not particularly sympathetic with women who claim they can't afford to buy pads or tampons once a month to cope with their menstrual period. These supplies can be budgeted for and then purchased along other supplies. I oppose schools providing pads for menstruating young women by leaving these supplies in school restrooms for the taking. I think most young women will take more of these products than their fair share. Young women need to learn to budget their own money for these supplies." Gina, thank you for sharing your perspective. You're welcome to join us as well. Again, 800-222-9455. Let's take a moment first now to listen to a few audio clips from young women in Central Illinois. Here's Dionysia Fabian, Gabby Sams, and Cher Wang reflecting on times that they've felt shame or embarrassment for having their period.
When I first got my period, I was in the fourth grade, and there was just one instance. It was maybe like my fourth or fifth time getting my period. I was sitting in my English class, and I was in a lot of pain. I would get cramps that would shoot up to my spine. And as a 10-year-old trying to focus and having those types of pain, you get super overwhelmed. And so I started to cry. I remember my teacher at the time, he came up to me and asked me why I was crying. And I said it was my time of the month and I was in a lot of pain. And he said, "Well, women every day deal with that. They're able to do everything and function as a normal human being, so you should too." So I kind of sat there and I like cried, and he yelled at me because I wouldn't stop crying. And then he made me get up and go to this desk that was in the corner, isolated by itself, and told me to sit there and think about my actions because I was causing a scene for no reason and it was unnecessary. But yeah, that was like the first time that I really felt ashamed to have my period and also like afraid.
My relatives were driving me up to an internship I had over the summer. We were almost there, but I was like, hey, like, guys, can we stop really quick? I have to go change my tampon before I get to this internship building. And my female relative just like turned her head towards me and she was like, don't talk about your period with your uncle in the car. He doesn't want to hear that. And I was just like, oh my God, you know? And I don't think my uncle really even cared. I think it made her more uncomfortable than it did my male relative. My female relative yelling at me for having a period or bringing up the fact that they exist, honestly, it made me more defiant. Like now I will like go out of my way to bring it up like, oh yeah, hey, like I need to go change my tampon. I'm on my period. I'll be right back, guys.
I don't think it's something to be ashamed of. I don't want to feel something to be ashamed of, but I just kind of get rid of the feeling that sometimes I feel guilty or shame. Growing up, they give the period a lot of nicknames. Like your relative is here, your auntie is here. They don't call it properly. That sort of impression passed down to me from older, more traditional, more conservative generation. And although I rationally know this is not something I should be ashamed of, I still felt a lot of conflict internally. For example, I have a partner right now. There are times when I'm at home and I might need him to help me get products. I feel guilty for asking him. And I'm getting emotional over this, but it's like a very conflict feelings to know it's not something I should be ashamed of. But at the same time, like having the feeling that this is not a very bright thing to be talking about.
Those were the voices of three young women in Central Illinois, Dionysia Fabian, Gabby Sams, and Cher Wang. That audio was produced by IPM student newsroom Sam Rink with reporting from Juliana Means as part of the Illinois Partnership for African Women's Health Narratives from the University of Illinois. We've been speaking with Aruba Fatima, a graduate student in biological anthropology at the University of Illinois, and Marnie Summer, a professor of sociomedical sciences at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. She's an expert in global health and development. We've got only about 10 minutes left for this conversation, so if you have a story or experience to share, 800-222-9455 is the number, and we've got a caller on the line, Dell in Champaign County. Dell, what would you like to share?
I'm calling to say that I'm working on opening a hygiene pantry for Champaign County. I am going to concentrate on period products, but also things like adult diapers, shampoo, anything hygiene related. I'm going to be doing the first drive for products at the Labor Day parade in Champaign, downtown Champaign. I'm still looking for a space to open this pantry, but it's a little early to talk about it, but I just wanted to get the word out.
Dell, thanks for your call. Thanks for sharing that. We also got this text from Sue in Elgin, who, in response to our text about menstrual shaming, said, yes, this is another way that women are characterized as less than through no fault of their own. Everyone is kept more ignorant by the stigma around menstruation and menopause. Even though it's central to reproductive justice at every level, women and our bodies are simultaneously controlled, dismissed, and taken for granted by society. I'd like to go to my guests now who are still on the line with us, Marnie Summer. I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of those messages we just heard or those stories that were shared. And I wonder if you could kind of, you know, just in an effort to bring us closer to home, talk about what are the greatest challenges surrounding menstrual equity throughout the U.S.?
So first of all, I love hearing what folks have texted or called in and also hearing those voices of their actual experiences, which did make me a little teary, but also really rang true with the research that we have done and others have done here in the U.S. I think myself included long thought this was not really a big issue in the U.S. And then during COVID, we did research with women across the country and found that many were using diapers or socks or other things to manage their periods because they had lost income or lost jobs and were really struggling to manage their periods. And similarly, our research and others have flagged that girls in school really also face challenges at all different ages. I'm glad someone spoke up about elementary school. I think sometimes people focus on middle schools and high schools, and they forget that a lot of young people maybe get their period when they're still in late elementary, which, you know, means there needs to be availability of support and products. So I think everything that you that was shared in the last sort of 5 or 7 minutes around these experiences really sticks to the evidence that we have. And one thing I would just say, you know, embarrassingly, I also, not embarrassing, I shouldn't say it like that, but I used to think, you know, do we really need to be providing products in schools? And then we started to do research and hear about some of the stories you just heard, girls being really shamed, embarrassed, not having time to get products. And we found that when products are made available, whether it's at university level or lower, there may be an initial rush on them because people don't think that they will stay. But then once they become, frankly, like toilet paper, which should just always be in any toilet or restroom anywhere in the world that uses toilet paper, people stop taking them unless they need them. It just becomes accepted that just like folks across the US need toilet paper when they go to the bathroom, that for those who have menstruating bodies, they need products. And so I would just say those things. The last quick thing for that great hygiene pantry that's happening, there's an organization called the Alliance for Period Supplies, which does really wonderful work bringing together new efforts, longstanding efforts to set up food pantries or integrate hygiene products into pantries. And they may be a good group to reach out to for support and guidance.
Aruba, I wanted to invite you to share your thoughts as well. Did you have any reflections on what was shared by any of the women here in Illinois or anything else you'd like to add to what Marnie just shared about challenges around menstrual equity in the U.S.?
I think these are all really great perspectives, and I completely agree with all of them. I really appreciate audiences calling in and also sending text messages. I think these are great for stirring conversations about menstruation and period poverty and menstrual equity. Like these are the things we need to keep talking about. This, I completely agree with Professor Summer about how the access to products conversation is right now and how we've all been at one point where we're thinking about how access to products should be and should not be, especially in schools or outside of schools as well. I invite audiences to really think about low-income or low to middle-income households where they don't have those kind of budgets, where they would have some sort of separate pool of money for menstrual products, and they do not have sufficient information about how to access reusable products. So think about those situations where folks don't have that kind of information, and having initiatives related to menstrual education awareness can really help them. Secondly, I really appreciate students sharing their sharing two forms of engagement related to menstruation with an older generation, but also currently engaging with like friends, family, they're in more intimate relationships as well. And I think one important thing that all of us sometimes have like this internal conflict to whether to discuss or not discuss because we're afraid of what kind of reaction might or might not come across. I think this is why we do what we do, and this is why we want to keep doing work on stigma and fighting the shame and silence around menstruation, because it's a collective experience that all menstruators are experiencing. And I have seen this in my work in Pakistan. I'm seeing this in my work in the UK. And I've also seen this in the Clancy Labs project on called Bleed Wax, where we look at responses of menstruators who experience some unusual experience after receiving the COVID vaccine. So there are so many different ways that menstruators are struggling with lack of information. And by having these conversations, we can really push the agenda forward.
We're quickly running out of time here, but Marnie, I wanted to kind of ask just your final thoughts, maybe in the last minute or two we have here, on, you know, what do you hope really sticks from our conversation today for people who are listening?
Yeah, I think I hope what sticks is that everyone realizes menstrual health is something you can talk about. Feel free to bring it up at the dinner table, in your workplace, in your educational environment. The number one way we can really transform people's lives is if we break the silence that Aruba and others have been talking about.
Marnie Sommer is a professor of socio-medical sciences at Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health, and Aruba Fatima is a graduate student in biological anthropology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Both of you, thank you so much for your insights and for joining us on the 21st show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you. It's been great.
And thanks for all of our callers and those who texted in to share your thoughts. We really appreciate the engagement. And that's all the time we have for today. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we'll talk about carbon sequestration, what it is, why people are concerned about potential risks to sole source aquifers like the Mahomet Aquifer in central Illinois. Before we go, please consider joining our texting group. It's the most popular way for listeners to share comments and questions on the show. Join by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, text the word TALK to 217-803-0730. We also appreciate hearing from you about our programs, and we'd love to hear your suggestions for future guests or stories. Send us an email at talk@21stshow.org. You can find that address and every other way to contact us, including our voicemail line, on our website, which is 21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. We've got all of our past shows there. You can find links to subscribe to our podcast or look us up on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. You can also now listen to our show on YouTube. Just search for the Illinois Public Media page. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield, Harrison Malkin, and Jose Zepeda. Leili Nazarova is an associate producer, and our digital producer is Kulsum Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Christine Herman in for Brian Mackey this week. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk with you again tomorrow.